Is it going to end there, really? Is that the end of the segment?
Yeah, that's where it's going to end.
That was a bit depressing. I can't end it there.
If not there, then where?
Oh, Jesus Christ, it just got even more profound.
Thursday, the 27th of July, 2017. It's Bad Voltage. I'm Stuart Langridge, and with me are Johnny Bacon and Jeremy Garcia. Hello, chaps. Yes.
Hello, how's it going?
Hello.
Sorry, terribly effusive introduction. I do apologise.
This is already awkward. Yes. Welcome to the show, everybody. So we're going to be we're going to go through the news as we normally do, which we've got some interesting stuff to share. But we're also going to have one main segment on this show, like we do sometimes. We're going to talk about screen time. We have tablets, we have phones, we have TVs, computers, Kindles, all kinds of different screens. Are we spending too much time on them, right? And there are research studies done into people becoming more narcissistic and people not present in scenarios and whatever else. We're really going to dip into that and really not really find any conclusions, but talk anyway, which is why you listen to Bad Voltage, right?
I know, but to be clear, they're listening to Bad Voltage, not looking at it on the screen, right? We're a podcaster. We're exempt from continuous partial attention. We want all your attention all time.
This is true. So if you're watching the YouTube video, play it and then minimize the window and then you're completely fine, okay?
And now... Bad Voltage.
Sorry, Jeremy.
Feeling pretty newsy right now.
I am.
Should we get newsed up?
Bring the news.
I've been listening to Jason Newsted all morning, so that's why.
Really, I'm going out for beer with Daniel News later on.
I'm out of news puns right now. Who wants to go first?
I wish there were no news puns.
Yeah, this is fair. All right, Langridge, why don't you start off?
I'll go first then. Right, so you remember the Silk Road, right? And Agora, illegal darknet market. A market for illegal things was the point.
Yes. Yes.
Well, there are a whole bunch of others, but two of the bigger ones were Hansa and Alpha Bay. Right, and the police... Okay. have shut them down. But what I thought was interesting about, I mean, fine, they're going to get shut down, whatever. But what I thought was interesting about this is, first of all, this has been a big international cooperation thing, right? The FEBs in America, the cops in the Netherlands, Europol, did a lot of international cooperation about this. And secondly, what they did was they seized the details of both and then shut down one of them, but kept the other one running. So everyone who was on the one they shut down moved over to the other one and then went, ha-ha, lol, also own that one.
It's like a mousetrap. That's
pretty coordinated, absolutely. Isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, part of the reason they managed to do this is because the Alpha Bay administrator sent all the password resets from his personal email, so good work, security. But what I thought was interesting is we had a discussion a couple of shows ago about the whole hackback idea and how... You can't imagine law enforcement agencies being competent to deal with that kind of situation. But this is exactly the opposite. It shows that there are at least some people inside law enforcement who do know what they're doing and put together a globally coordinated effort to shut this kind of thing down. You know, I thought it was quite interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair to law enforcement, I mean, I think they do generally know what they're doing. I think some elements of law enforcement probably don't, but... It's irrespective. It's great to see this is happening. I can't think of a place I want to go less than the dark web. Right? Like I'd rather go, you know, to Bilston. That's unfair, actually.
That's downright mean to Bilston.
I've got nothing against Bilston. I was just trying to pick somewhere random. Anyway, very good. All right. Well, I have a very quick news item to share. So news was shared a little while ago, earlier this week. That Microsoft were planning on killing off Microsoft Paint.
They were.
The venerable digital painting application that's been on Windows for the last 32 years.
Oh, that's ridiculous.
Apparently. Which is nuts. So there was a public outpouring of support for Microsoft Paint. People were were bereaved at the idea of of getting rid of it. So Microsoft have thus
given it a
changed
a stay
their
of
tune,
execution.
Shall we say? Yeah, and they said today we've seen incredible outpouring of support and nostalgia around Microsoft Paint. If there's anything that we've learned, it's that after 32 years, Microsoft Paint has a lot of fans. Read weirdos. It's been amazing to see how much love there's been for our trusty apps amid today's commentary around Microsoft Paint. We wanted to take this opportunity to set the record straight. It's here to stay. It'll just have a new home soon in the Windows Store, where it'll be available for free. So it sounds like it's not going to be shipped by default. You'll just be able to go and download it, and then they'll quietly.
I presume that you came across this news story while doing research for your upcoming review of the all-new Microsoft Paint. Given your history of reviewing very old things, this is old even for you.
It's a little bit cutting edge for me, I think. I think we might need to review PaintShop Pro instead.
It is massively unclear to me whether this was always their plan or whether they saw this huge backlash. I mean, and let's be clear, it's not a serious backlash. No one actually wants things. It's just nostalgia. But since I find myself having to explain PR to a company who wrote this program when I was 9, right, you could have done this and just said, we're going to put it in the store from the beginning, or just open source it for lols.
Well,
right?
They might.
You say...
They might have wanted to get rid of it and then realized it's just easier to put in the store. Who knows?
You say that this wasn't a serious backlash. I don't think it's serious. Well, at least it's not serious to me. I couldn't give a shit about Microsoft Paint. But I bet you anything, there's some people generally pretty aggrieved by the notion of and it's not because it's of any value. It's just like it's change.
Yes.
A lot of people don't like change. So who cares about Microsoft Paint?
Although they really should open source it. We should start a petition.
Yeah, just like people, open source it. It's not like for a lot of things. I mean, Flash, for example, there's a lot of proprietary technology and stuff like that in there, probably. There's a lot in graphics drivers and all that sort of thing, fine. But there can't be that much in Microsoft Paint.
You don't think there's a lot of competitive trade secrets in the code of Microsoft Paint?
I do not. In fact, believe there is a whole bunch of really complicated secret graphics technology in Microsoft Paint.
I'm assuming they just don't want to clean it of the absurd comments that it has accumulated over 32 years.
Yeah, it's going to be like decrepit old pot shots at Coral Draw and
exactly.
Stuff like that.
Companies that we forgot existed.
In your so face, Zara X. Well, the top of
so there you go. Microsoft Paint is here to stay.
Hang on. Not only does
Coral
Draw not exist, the Coral exist.
They're probably like some subsidiary Chinese company. Like, you know, I bet you anything, Coral Draw probably still exists. You know, it's probably shipping with BIOS or something. I don't know. So
port to Linux. Oh my God, the official website for the Coral Draw family of products. Coral Draw Home and Student costs £80.
That's a family no one wants to visit. That's like the weird uncle and auntie on Boxing Day. You really don't want to go and see.
It's kind of like, you know, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre family or something. Coral Photo Paint 2017.
Looking up Coral right now, not only are they still around as a company, they're still making acquisitions.
Really?
As recently as August 2016, they acquired Mind Manager. Do you remember Roxio?
Yeah.
They acquired that in 2012.
The people who made the DVD burner, CD burner stuff?
Yeah. They made Toast and a couple other things. They acquired PaintShop Pro. They acquired Video Studios.
I suppose they need to fight against their biggest competitor, Nero Burning ROM.
Exactly.
Wow. That is like just a bastion of just old technology. Everyone's sat around on like Toshiba Tough Books. Just
that's not fair.
Living the dream.
That's not fair. I've just searched for best art package on Lycos and Coral Draw was top.
Wow. I can't access it on my phone because my phone doesn't have WAP.
Oh, what a nice trip down
younger listeners have
lane.
Got no idea what we're talking about.
Given the firm booting we've had for talking about computers from our childhood, which most of which got out of production before half our audience were born, we probably want to talk about newer. Because people go, I never had a Commodore 64 because they stopped producing it 5 years before I was born. Stop talking about this stuff.
We're getting old, fellas. We should probably stop talking about decrepit old technologies that are probably going to be wrapped up anytime soon. So what's next, Jeremy?
Actually, it fits right in, given what Stuart just said. It's about Adobe Flash, which they are finally killing off for good, December 31st of 2020. Now, really? I worked at...
I want your Flash.
I've worked at multiple web design companies, and I know Stuart is a web guy, so I'm sure we both have strong opinions on this one. What surprised me the most is that this was still considered a big enough announcement that Apple, Google, Facebook, Mozilla, and Microsoft all gave out a coordinated announcement about it.
Yeah. Well, you see, here is the thing. I am unlike a lot of people on this, and
you
I
like
have
Flash.
Repeatedly, I don't want it to go away. I have repeatedly, and at some personal cost over the last 10 years or so, expressed this opinion and been shouted at for it. But there's a whole bunch of things like little games and kids' educational software and stuff like that, which just hasn't been replaced, right? If you look at something like Kongregate, there's loads of really cool little games there from the last 10 years. People are still making them today,
right?
And they just all stop working when Flash dies. What I want Adobe to do is open source it and give it to Mozilla or something, you know? Or help the Shumway team, or provide something which compiles it into... I mean, they specifically made the point people should switch over to HTML5 and WebGL and WebAssembly and so on, and that's the right thing to do. But I want them to basically port Flash to JavaScript and then implement it as on top of open web technology so all this stuff doesn't just die.
Is there not a thing that just... Literally an automated thing that ports it Flash to
A bunch of people have tried. You may remember Gnash and Lightspark, which were attempts to make free Flash years ago.
What I mean is that was free implementation of Flash. What I'm talking about is something that will port a Flash application to a, you know, some current whatever. I don't know much about this area.
Same thing. Same thing, unfortunately. If you could build a free Flash implementation, you could then implement the way that free Flash thing renders stuff in terms of WebGL or whatever. So that was what Shumway was trying to be, but it never got the resources from the Mozilla team. I'd like to see that happen. I just don't want to see all of that stuff die. It seems a shame. But you can't, it's hard to make this argument in between the people who go, you just want to keep Flash, you suck, man, move to HTML5. And I want Flash things to go away. I just think there's a huge library.
I think the thing that's tough, even if they open source it, the attack surface area of the Flash player is so large, and vulnerabilities keep getting found. Like, the number of 0 days that over the years have been in Flash is astounding.
Yeah, that's true.
I wonder whether, I mean, to be clear, my opinion on this is purely around things like kids' educational resources, little games, stuff like that. I don't care about all the streaming live video, DRM, talk to your webcam security stuff at all. If that all gets dropped and things that use that lose, then fine. I'm not worried about that.
So you want to put all that engineering work into stripping things out of Flash?
What I want the Adobe people to do is to say, here's the source. If someone wants to do that, get stuck in. I assume they can't because they've got a bunch of licensed proprietary technology that they're not allowed to discuss, unfortunately. But
it'd be interesting.
You can't get them to talk about this.
It'd be interesting if they, to Jeremy's point about there being, it's probably a giant bucket of security vulnerabilities. It'd be interesting if they basically announced, we are going to set up a public open source, like we're going to make this open source, but then they were to almost like start it out as a closed open source project until they can do a bunch of housekeeping around this stuff and kind of clear it up a little bit. And then when they open it up, because I'd be worried if they open sourced it, that it would be a nightmare in terms of like security issues with these kinds of.
Oh, maybe things. I mean, to be honest with you, I can imagine, say the Mozilla team or someone like that sitting in a room building an implementation of Flash, and there just happened to be a bunch of Adobe engineers sat in the same room. You know, having a coffee and answering questions with reference to a secret copy of the source code on their own laptops or whatever, right?
We've talked
a dirty room like, re-implementation.
So isn't that what Google did with Pepper Flash?
Sort of.
Well, not exactly, but right.
And it's not very clear what the future of Pepper is.
I have I just literally lost interest at that moment. Did you hear it? Wow, that was quick and unexpected.
Fine.
Anyway,
no flash for you. So end of the news.
So stay tuned for the next episode of Bad Voltage, where John O'Bacon reviews Microsoft Paint.
So I want to talk about a bit of a quandary that I've got right now. I, like you guys, spend a significant chunk of my life in front of screens. I spend all day in front of a computer. Most days, apart from at conferences, I spend time in front of a tablet, you know, watching TV shows, in front of a TV, watching TV stuff, and in between those moments, looking at my phone. Ever since I've become a dad, I've become a lot more aware of being present in the situation. This is something that Jeremy said on a previous segment was, you know, if you're on your phone or you're on a screen, you're not present in the physical world that you're in at that particular point. So recently I started flirting with the idea of getting a smartwatch. And one of the reasons why I've historically, we'll get there, Mr. Langridge. Don't worry. You'll be able to let the venom out. Okay. So one of the reasons why I've historically rejected the idea of a smartwatch is because I just don't want another thing that's pestering for my attention, right? Like my phone takes up enough of that. You know, I use my phone for email and social media and whatever else. But it got me thinking to the wider component here, which is like, what is the healthy balance of screen time? Because I'll give you an example. When I go on holiday, I generally am very, very disciplined about not looking at phones, right? So I don't have my computer with me. Well, I bring it, but I only bring it in case of an emergency. I rarely open it. The only screen that I look at is a Kindle, where I'm laid on a deck chair drinking cocktails and reading a book. But I think that as society ages, as we kind of move forward, people are more and more addicted to screens. And I think that my theory is that what's going to happen in the same way that people are increasingly interested in health, that screen health or the lack of time on a screen is going to become an increasing concern.
Right.
Where it's not just about, you know, making sure that you get exercise and eating well and recycling. One of the other responsible citizenry things is going to be not spending too much time in front of the screen. Discuss.
I would agree. I mean, I think the implications of the amount of screen time that we all have is probably underestimated. And there's some pretty good studies coming out now that, you know, social media in general appears to make people more narcissistic, which we certainly don't need. Smartphones, I think, are certainly having a pretty detrimental impact on sleep health in general, sleep patterns in general. I think there's pretty good research behind the fact that screens seem to be making our kids less empathetic, which I think is troubling. And even beyond that, just, you know, if you're out in a room, you're in a pub with Stuart Langridge chatting about things, 20 years ago, a trivia question came up or something came up and people discussed it. They not argued angrily, but they, you know, there was a little discussion back and forth about why you were wrong and why I was right. And that led to people telling stories and people getting to know each other. And that's a lot of times how inside jokes and stuff are formed. Where now when something like that comes up, someone Googles it and the discussion's over in 8 seconds. And I think that's having a pretty deep implications in the way that we interact with each other as humans. And I would portend not in a good way.
Yeah, what do you think, Mr. Langridge?
I don't agree with either of you, I'm afraid.
Explain to us why you're wrong.
Yeah. The addict speaks.
let me Google why you're incorrect.
When I'm sitting in the pub with people, I mean, Jono was here only last weekend, and we went out for beers, and we were out for the whole evening, and
we were.
At no point did I tell him, no, I've got to stop now to look at my phone, right? If it's interesting to be in the situation, if it's interesting to be present in the room, then be present in the room, definitely. And I don't think people are being particularly stopped. The difference is now, we grew up in an environment when If you were bored by what was happening around you, you had no choice but to pretend to look interested. Now, you don't have to anymore. And everyone's kind of, oh, but everyone doesn't seem to be interested. Like, no one ever was interested. It's like going to your granny's at Christmas, right? You had to sit there and pretend that it was fun because you didn't have any alternative. Now, fine, you go, if you see a whole family sitting there and they're all on their phones and not talking to one another, maybe they need to be better friends, fine, and that's something to work on, but it's just the same as it was before. I'm closer to the two of you than I am to the people who live next door to me. Why should an accident of geography be the thing which dictates where I am and what I do?
So I agree with that last part about the geography thing, but I think your point about spending time with family when you're a kid is illustrative of why you're incorrect. When I was seven and I had to go to, you know, my nana's for Christmas Eve, did I probably piss and moan about it and think I didn't enjoy it? Yeah. But I had to be there in the moment because I didn't have a phone or tablet. Do I now look back very, very fondly at those times? Yeah. If I would have been on my phone all that whole time, would I now look at that very fondly? Probably not.
I'll give you an example of that, actually. Last Christmas... I gave you my heart.
What happened on Boxing Day?
he gave it away.
So last Christmas, we went to England and went to stay with my mum and dad's, and my brother and his family were over. And he's got two kids, right? Both of which are kind of 13, 14 years old. And they sat on the couch staring at their phones constantly. And they had to be asked to, like, turn them off. Like, they were just literally wedded to their phones. And on one hand, it's like, yeah, I get what you're saying, Ag. Like, I think that the thing that's great about phones in particular, for example, is one of the things I like about them is that you can go to a pub and you can be in a social environment if you're out by yourself. And you can look at your phone. Like, you can not feel like the awkward weirdo in the side of the room who's sat by yourself. You can be engaging with people online, but you can also be sat in a pub just having a quiet drink. But on the other hand, you get situations like that where you get a couple of people who are just literally not engaged in the situation.
Right.
And I don't know whether it's screens. Like, I don't, like, it's easy to say screens are the fault, but I also wonder whether this is a social media thing. Because the thing that does worry me is, I remember one time someone on the internet posted a picture of a salad and, you know, like, this is what's for dinner. And I was thinking, who cares? Like, I actually posted, who cares? You know?
Of course,
like,
you did.
I don't care. But but then again, people don't care about half the shit that I post, right? I mean, when I post a picture of a brisket that I've smoked, who cares about that?
No.
So it's difficult to determine where to draw the line.
And it was really difficult when we were younger, when you had to take a Polaroid of that brisket and then go around to all of your friends in the car and show it to them, right? but more importantly, there are, I think, two different thought processes here. You've got mine, you got what I think, what everyone else thinks. Right? You got, my one is that it's actually not a problem and this is a kind of an adaption. But the alternative is someone called Linda Stone, late 90s, I think, or early 2000s, came up with this concept of continuous partial attention. The idea that you kind of had this, from a programming terminology, it would be a background thread, right? This kind of a small part of your attention at all times is on things like your social media stream. A small part of your attention at all times is on stuff like this. You're never fully in the moment. And yes, I admit my whole thing about, wow, I'm friends with people around the world and you're trying to suppress me from that and make me live in the moment is a complete caricature, right? I don't necessarily feel like that. And we probably do spend too much time looking at screens. But equally, I think the view of how it was all marvellous until kids started looking at Instagram and that's ruined families is just as rose-tinted in the other direction, right? So we're kind of, yes, I think maybe people looking at screens too much, but I think it's more that... Now you've got the choice to do that. And we've adjusted a bit too far in that direction. And we probably need to pull back. But it's hard to distinguish the argument of we're spending too much time on screens from people who are like, we should stop doing that entirely. And you should play dominoes with your family because that's what proper people do.
And I don't think we should stop it. I would liken it a little bit in many ways to fast food, right? Is that in America, I would say that there's a lot more fast food over here than there is in the UK. Like in the UK, when I was growing up, there was Burger King, Kentucky Fried Chicken, possibly McDonald's.
Wimpy. Wimpy is a perfect example. People in America who don't know about Wimpy, right? Wimpy is a perfect example of how Britain just doesn't really get the concept of fast food, which is a very American sort of idea, right? Wimpy, you went in there and you bought a burger and they brought it out to you with table service on a china plate with a knife and fork, right?
It is so English. But it's like, over here, there's loads and loads and loads and loads of options for various bits of fast food. And the view it could be, that's fine. Like, people can choose to do what they want. And some people go to fast food places all the time. Some people don't go ever. And some people go a little bit. But broadly, we have a pretty fat society in the US. And arguably, that's because of poor diets and lack of exercise and whatever else. I think it's the same thing with screen time. Is there's like your example earlier on, Ak, of when we went out to have beers the other night, you're really good at that. Like, you don't sit on your phone. You don't sit at a table. The only time when you get your phone out is if someone goes for a pee, right? Or if a trivia question comes up in conversation. You don't sit there and ignore the rest of the table and sit on your phone. But I think some people who aren't responsible, in the same way that some people aren't responsible with what they eat, people aren't responsible with screen time. And what worries me about it is that because a big chunk of that screen time is social media, and because that drives some negative habits and that, you know, narcissism, whatever else, that's not a particularly good thing.
Right.
So, but I don't know. I mean, what's the solution to this? Like, how do we solve this? If we agree that there are some people who spend too much time on the screen and they're not present, no, how do you think we can solve
it? Wait for the fad to burn out, basically.
You think it's a fad?
Yeah. Yes, I do.
I don't think it's
you think
fad.
Social media is a fad, or you think yes, the never-ending constant flow of information via digital devices is a fad?
Well, here is a question for you, right? If we think spending too much time looking at screens is bad, imagine Google Glass had taken off, or something like it had taken off. So you can basically have a screen built into your retina the whole time, presumably a very high DPI screen if it was built into your retina. You have a screen built into your retina the whole time. No, literally, not even a courtesy laugh. I thought that was quite good.
That was terrible.
So
I did consider a courtesy laugh, if that helps.
Wow, really? I didn't even get a pity laugh. That's terrible. Imagine you've got a screen built in the whole time, but no one can see you doing it. So what will happen is people will sort of drift off in conversation. You think you're just looking at your Twitter feed on your invisible scrolling screen. Would that be just as bad? Is the point that people are explicitly turning their attention away and you can see that they're doing it, or not? Is it okay if you can't tell they're doing it? And if that's the case, I don't understand what the difference is between people spending time looking at their retina built-in Twitter screen and people spending time contemplating the cosmos rather than talking.
I don't think the look of the screen has much to do with it.
Right, but then what's the
location of the screen or whatever.
What's the difference between someone scrolling through their Twitter feed in their head and contemplating the nature of truth in their head? In both of those things, they're not listening to you.
Right. I think the latter is less likely to happen randomly in the middle of a conversation, because your brain doesn't pop up a notification saying, contemplate this hand-wavy thing, where your phone does.
My brain.
Yeah.
Maybe my brain does and everyone else's doesn't.
Your brain is, in lots of different ways, I'd say this with the greatest of truth and respect, your brain is a different brain.
Okay, so my brain does not resemble your earth brains. Fine, I get that. So.
But I mean, I think part of it as well is, there is the immediate kind of like someone looking away and not being present, which I think is a bit annoying, but it's not that big of a deal. To me, the bigger, wider issue here is just people who are like, they have to suck on the teat of attention constantly, right? And again, I'm in two minds on this because on one hand, there is something really cool about when you post, like when I post a picture of Jack to Facebook, or me hanging out with Jack, or the three of us hanging out as a family, and it gets 50 likes. It's nice. It's like a nice element of humor. It's like it shows that people, even in a little way, recognize, you know, family and all the rest of it. And I think that's a good thing. But on the other hand, it's just it's just this like narcissistic,
well,
this narcissistic culture that we are developing, you know. And I see this, I just see this brutally on what do people call it? Faux booking, or there's a thing where you post like a sentence to Facebook, you don't really say what it is.
Vague booking.
And it, vague booking. Oh my god!
In the hope that people will ask you about it. Yeah, you're fishing for attention. Question for you.
Irritating.
So, 10 years ago, or 20 years ago, or 30 years ago, or 500 years ago, do you think people were actually less narcissistic, or do you think they would have been? They just didn't have the opportunity to express it. Is the problem that we're feeding a desire that people have always had, or have the 2010s created narcissism that genuinely wasn't there before?
I think there's more narcissism.
I think they've fostered narcissism in a way that increases it, but certainly not created it.
Yeah.
Right. Because, I mean, I'm utterly convinced if you took a bunch of people from 1500s and gave them this kind of immediate Pavlovian feedback, they'd find it just as cool as we do. Right?
I think it's somewhat innate to the human condition, so I would concur. Yeah.
I think what's happened is it's made narcissism socially acceptable.
Yeah.
In the eyes of some.
Well, anything that proliferates to that degree becomes almost socially acceptable, right? That's just, if you see something everywhere, it has that impact.
Grandfathered in by definition. So, if everyone's doing a thing, it is the norm. It's a descriptive rather than prescriptive attitude to life, but if you're going to be prescriptive about it, then you're a religion. So,
But I think that when you see overt examples of narcissism, it's also socially unacceptable to call people out on it because you just come across as a bit of a dick. So what happens is, people do it and people don't feel like they can confront it. Like I could tell you right now, 10 people who are friends of mine, who I'm connected to on Facebook. I assure you, neither of you are included in this list, who are phenomenally narcissistic.
Do I still have a Facebook account? I'd have to check.
I actually don't know. Who are phenomenally narcissistic in almost everything that they post. But I can guarantee you, I'm not going to share with other people who those people are. I'm not going to mention it on a podcast because that'd just be a dick thing to do.
But there's such a sliding scale here. I mean, be honest, right? The three of us are currently having a conversation and daring to assume that other people want to listen to it.
Right.
To some extent, any kind of public performance at all is narcissistic by that definition. It's really hard to come up with a bright line test.
I don't think so.
I think part of the reason we do this show and part of why many people do things is that we genuinely enjoy it, right? We get a good laugh. It's nice that people listen, and it's certainly encouraging when we get feedback and all that. But I think we do it because we like it.
True. No, don't get me wrong. I'm not suggesting that we're doing this just because people tell us that it's good or whatever. But that's a part of it. And I think
not really.
I think there is, to some extent, anyone who genuinely doesn't like that stuff, why do public performances? Why even bother?
I think there's a difference. I think there's a difference between, I don't consider someone who does something because they enjoy the audience experience, right? Whether it's they're in the theater, whether they play music, whether they do podcasts, or whether they write articles and they enjoy that validation of their work. I don't think that's been narcissistic. I think that's the performer instinct in a lot of people.
Okay, fair point.
To be narcissism is when people have an elevated level of their personal kind of like capabilities or their personal like notoriety in a particular community. Like that to me is narcissism. Like we've been doing Bad Voltage for 2-3 years now, and I don't believe we've ever gone out there and told people like, yeah, we're really good. Like we're a great podcast. Like we're one of the best podcasts. The only time we've ever said that has been like being incredibly sarcastic.
You see my point about how it's hard for there to be a bright line test about this, right? Which is why it's hard to call people out.
That's fair.
Because if you say it's now socially acceptable to call people out, a lot of call outs won't be genuine. There'll be jealousy. And that's possible. I don't know if I can necessarily say that's a worse environment, but it's certainly not good.
But that's where I think it's socially unacceptable to do that because, you know, to me, and this is a bit of a detour, but it's related. I think an example of this in my mind is my dad's career. Right, my dad was raised in a very, very kind of like working class Northern English kind of environment, But he was a little bit different to his brothers and sisters because he was always like a bit entrepreneurial. So what happened was when he started doing well for himself, a lot of the people who he grew up with were like, well, he's bloody lucky, right? So there was kind of a resentment towards that. Whereas some of the people on the upper end of the society would be like, well, look at him. He's just like a freaking northerner, just, you know, trying to scramble his way up his bootstraps. And I think that narcissism is the same way. Like some people who can, you know, who genuinely deserve the praise, I think other people would kind of reject that praise. So this is where I think, like, to your point, Ak, it's complicated, but it's something that's festering in society. So
I take your point. I mean, the dictionary definition, or a dictionary definition of,
yeah, what is it?
Of narcissism is that it's the pursuit of gratification from vanity or egotistic admiration of one's own attributes. But probably a better one would be it's excessive interest in or admiration of oneself or one's physical appearance. And the key word there is probably excessive.
Yeah.
Right.
But obviously, again, bright line test here. You can't put up a thing that says, if you are really good, then you're allowed to say that you're really good, and that's all right.
Yeah.
Because it's obviously massively subjected to gerrymandering by whoever gets to decide what goodness is.
So there's also context as well, right? Because, for example, if you have a product or a service and you're pitching towards a customer, then it's normal to kind of sing your praises, right? You know, like if Cryogenics Consulting is talking to a client, I would expect Cryogenics Consulting to be saying, you know, I'm really good at
what
I do. We're
genuinely really good at this. Yeah, exactly. Totally.
I take pride in my work and et cetera, et cetera. So it's okay then, but like, it's not okay in other areas.
If I would say that in the pub, then that would be weird. So question, because we've strayed a little far afield from screen time here.
Imagine
a world in which people were still looking at screens all the time, but they weren't doing it because of social media. They weren't doing it for narcissistic reasons. People were basically looking at it because they were reading Wikipedia or reading books, or essentially they are genuinely at that point finding other knowledge more interesting than what they're doing in the room. Would that be bad? Is the point screens, or is the point that people are spending their time doing things which seem kind of ultimately worthless? Are you allowed to look at screens all the time if what's on the screen is the Encyclopedia Britannica?
You know, I don't know, Jeremy.
I still think you're, depending contextually on how you're, what you mean, you're still not in the moment, right? And if you're not in the moment, then why be there?
Knocked speechless by Jeremy's profundity there, Jono.
Sorry, my line, the connection went wobbly for a second. I was not speechless, I just didn't hear it. What did you say, Jeremy?
Okay, I was speechless, Jeremy, so try again.
What did you say?
I don't think it matters if it was a Britannica or a screen. I think if you're not, like I said, if you're doing something else, you're not in the moment. And if you're not in the moment, then be in a different moment, that's fine. And, I think maybe we've... The constant access to information, I'm a huge fan of, and I think it's definitely irrevocably changed the world. And I think for the better in the grand scheme of things, but in the attention facet of that is a little bit dangerous. And I don't know the right answer there, but I think the never-ending constant distractions are going to have social implications that we won't understand for a long time. And the thing is, I'm not saying every conversation you're in has to be interesting, right? That's not how the world works. But maybe dealing with those in a saner way would behoove everyone.
I agree with you. I think it's more about being present in the scenario. And I don't really think it's got anything to do with what you're interested in or what you're doing, whether it's meaningful. It reminds me of a conversation when Ak was over here visiting one time. And Erica, my wife, was moaning about the fact that she gets on BART to come home from the city, and she couldn't get a seat, and the people who were sat down weren't doing anything. They were like sat playing games on their phone or something like that. And she was like, I want to grab a seat so I can sit down and work. And she was complaining about that. And Ak said, I forget exactly how you put it, but it was beautifully, beautifully laid out, where he basically said, yeah, I mean, it's terrible, isn't it? You know, someone sitting there and just, you know, relaxing or like not doing anything. And it was a difference in personality where, Like, for Erica is like ultra efficient about everything. And some people aren't like that. And there's nothing wrong with that. Like, for example, when I go downstairs and make a coffee, I'm not reading my email. I'm watching a YouTube video because that's part of how I like to enjoy my life. So I don't think it's really got anything. Screen time is, to me, has got nothing to do with what you're doing. It's more about being present in the situation.
But for both of those, right, whether you're reading your email or you're watching a YouTube video, still doing it on the screen, maybe you should be doing neither of those two things.
Right. Well, there is that. And part of the reason why I do that is if there's no one else around. Like, if somebody else comes into a room and I'm on my phone, I'll immediately put it away. You know, not everyone's like that. But
no.
I don't know. I feel like I haven't got any answers. This was all a waste of time.
Turn the screen back on.
Is it going to end there, really? Is that the end of the segment?
Yeah, that's where it's going to end.
That was a bit depressing. I can't end it there.
If not there, then where?
Oh, Jesus Christ. It just got even more profound.
Well, to be fair, I wasn't paying attention. I was looking at my screen, so I don't even know what you said.
So there we have it. Show.
Yes.
Jeremy is with us for a few minutes, but then he's going to have to drop off to go and do his important Datadog-related missionary work.
Yes.
So, Jeremy, have you got anything to say, anything to share that's before you have to drop off that's amazing, insightful, and riveting?
I don't think I do. I am interested what the listeners think about the screen time thing, because this seems like something where people have vastly different opinions. Because as you kind of mentioned in the segment, ACK is very good. Having been to the pub with ACK, is very good at being on his phone all the time. And other people that I'm either friends with or acquaintances with or just observe are not that good. It's kind of funny. I was on the subway not that long ago, and someone actually commented out loud that they don't use their phone on the subway because they find it fascinating to look around and see so many people not interacting.
Well, there's that picture that people keep posting of like, from like the 30s of people all looking at newspapers.
All looking at newspapers.
Right?
Yes. Exactly the same. This is not like a new concept, right? The idea it's that not. People won't talk to one another on the tube has been there since there was the tube. I think they built the tube in order to provide a hole in the ground for awkwardness to happen in.
It is like, I don't want to talk to anyone on public transportation generally. I like the different situations. Like, you, if you're in a bar, like if I'm in a bar or a restaurant, I will talk to pretty much anyone. But if I'm on public transportation, I will generally very rarely. But someone has to strike up the conversation with me. I ain't going to be striking it.
Have you thought about working for the tourism board for the London Underground? Because that should be their tagline almost.
It absolutely. The problem is if you talk to people on the bus, then you're the nutter on the bus, to quote Jasper Carr. No one wants to be the nutter on the bus, right?
What about airline seats?
What about?
Because like, I generally, again, if I'm on a plane, I feel bad, because if I'm on a plane, if someone strikes up a conversation with me, who's sat next to me, I will put in the bare minimum of conversation, and then I will basically try to eject as quickly as possible.
And some people love talking on planes. Love it.
I'm really bad at it, because I talk to people not on a plane. You know, and they'll say, yeah, I was on this plane and we had this really good conversation about barbecue wave all the way over the Atlantic. And I'm like, really? My God. I can't imagine talking to someone. I mean, I hate plane travel, which doesn't help.
Right.
But the idea that I'd love to just sit there and chat. Maybe I'll just sit next to the wrong people or something.
The worst thing is when you get on a flight, particularly an international flight, and you see someone you know. Lined up, and you're like, oh God, I don't have to make small talk for 10 hours. And it happened one time where I got sat next to someone who I kind of knew in the industry. And we actually had a really nice conversation for 20 minutes, and then he basically took an Ambien, knocked himself out for 10 hours.
just to get away from the conversation, presumably.
I will take full credit for that.
I actually cut off one of my legs at one point to avoid having a conversation with someone all the way home on a plane.
Well, it's different as well. If you take a short flight, when I was working at Expo, you know, to fly to LA, it's like an hour. So like if someone wants to have a conversation for an hour, fine. I don't care. That's fine with me.
Right.
But if it's, you know, 11 hours, like, oh, geez,
I actually apologize. There was one, there was a UDS actually, and flying back from it, and someone else on the same plane as me. And I sent them an email afterwards saying, I'm sorry I was such an antisocial bastard, but I was really tired. I believe we'd been up drinking until something like 5 a.m. and then I got on a plane at half six or something ridiculous. and I just said to him, I'm really sorry, man. I was completely antisocial all the way home and sorry about that. And he was like, no, it's fine. Yeah. Don't worry about it. You can see him thinking, not really actually fine. But, you know.
Good for you.
Sorry.
Different social contexts demand different things.
They do. And it's a genuinely interesting thing. As you say, I mean, public transport is completely different. But a lot of that is conditioning, right? If everyone talked on public transport, then everyone would talk on public transport and it wouldn't be weird. But you can't be, you can't be the groundbreaker in this because then you're just the nutter on the bus.
Yes. So, so I'm curious to also hear about what people think. Get your views in on the Bad Voltage forum, community.badvoltage.org. We've had some really cool discussion there recently. Like, it's been interesting hearing all of, you know, everybody reminiscing about old computers on there, which has been unsurprisingly a popular thread.
There was one about someone's kickstarted a recreated camera lens from sort of 1900 or something. And it's beautiful. I mean, I really like all that kind of Victorian brass. Intricately made stuff. It's ridiculous. Things like £900, right? Which, as far as I'm concerned, is the amount of money you spend on 900 lenses, not a lens. But I got one of those magnifying glasses in a cracker when I was a kid. That can't cost more than £1, surely. But but the thing itself is beautiful. And I think it's really interesting, you know. There are a bunch of YouTube series about maths, things like that, which I quite like. And every now and again, you'll see someone using a little piece of maths technology from the turn of the century, these incredibly intricately made slide rules and stuff like that, or made out of beautiful brass and things. And it's really cool. You think we're missing something by just typing it into the slide rule app on your phone?
Well, if there was any ambiguity from the previous conversation about whether we're getting old, Ack is getting into antiques, so it's official now.
I like mechanical engineering. I like things which work through some clever mechanical principle, rather than being you do this and then that activates a servo and then a battery just controls this other thing to run.
The Rube Goldberg solution to everything.
I do, but not things which are genuinely complicated. Just little things like, you know, salad spinners or ratchet screwdrivers or corkscrews, or where they've got a clever little thing where this little bit moves over and then tips that little bit and that happens. Not some huge, great big Heath Robinson mousetrap style.
Have you watched James May's The Reassembler?
No. Yeah. What's that?
It's quite good.
Oh my God, Langridge, you are going to... You might want to close the curtains for this one. So James May does a series called The Reassembler, where he basically takes, for example, an electric guitar, and it's been disassembled into, you know, 1,000 pieces, and he basically reassembles it. And he has that lovable, affable James May kind of, you know, way of talking.
It is James May distilled.
And it takes a great degree of, like, care and attention. It's really satisfying to watch.
Oh, I'll have a crack at that then.
You would love that. There's loads of them on YouTube.
Is this YouTube thing, or is it some kind of legacy TV program?
Apparently they're still making it for BBC Two, but there's a bunch of episodes on YouTube. Obviously iPlayer, so.
Nice.
Yeah, you'd like that.
I'll have a look at that on iPlayer then. Winner. Okay, brilliant. Yeah. I have actual news. We received an email, and I promised I'd mention it. OgCamp is a free software conference here in the UK. It's happening in...
Very good.
We mentioned it in a previous show, which means that you should listen to that if you want to remember what the date is, because I can't remember. Jono, look up the date for when OgCamp is. But the important point is they need crew, right? People to help out on the day, volunteers. And you get... you get a very cool exclusive t-shirt and you get to feel like you're a part of something, and it's a really nice thing to do, and it's cool. It's a cool conference, right? I'm probably going to go. So if you're interested in being part of the crew, then you need to contact a bloke called John Spriggs. So if you email him at ogcamp@sprig.gs, S-P-R-I-G.
He's a nice guy.
He is. John Spriggs is a cool guy. So, email John the Nice Guy at ogcamp@sprig.gs if you're interested in being part of the crew.
So Ogcamp, so you know, is in Canterbury in the UK, and it's on Saturday and Sunday, the 19th and 20th of August, 2017. Also, we should say it's sponsored by Entraware, the Canterbury Christ Church University, and Ubuntu. And yeah, it's great. I mean, I haven't been for a number of years because I live in the US now, but I've been to a couple of them, and it's absolutely brilliant. So go and check it out. And tickets are... How much are they?
Free.
The tickets are free, but you can also make a donation, and there's a delegate ticket, which is £25.
Yeah, you should make a donation if you can, because then it enables them to put the event on without having to clamour to too many people for sponsorship, and it means that all the people who actually can't afford it... I mean, I'm not talking about spending £100 on a ticket here, right? But chuck them five. It is the done thing.
Yeah, yeah. It's cool, though.
So yes.
It's very cool. And Stephen Fry actually did a little thing for Ogcamp in 2012.
He did. He did, absolutely.
We love the Ogcamp thing.
We do. Are you speaking at any conferences in the next couple of weeks?
I don't know. Let me check my calendar.
Monsieur E. Le Bacon.
Calendar is a mess. No, by the looks of things. Next thing I'm going to is going to be Open Source Summit in Los Angeles, and then which is in September. I'd encourage everyone to go there. I'm running the Open Community Conference, and then also the Open Source Summit in Prague in October, which we are currently making roomifications, not that that's a word, to Langridge to get out there and join us. You will be pressured until you submit to our viewpoints.
I have heard that. I'm not speaking at any conferences, but I did get interviewed in a podcast, which is pretty cool.
Which one?
You know Jess Rose, right?
Yeah, Jess, she's brilliant.
Jess is brilliant. And she's just started a podcast called Pursuit Pod. And it's for people who are new to the world of tech, new to development, new to getting into this side of things. And it's a whole bunch of things about how to get into public speaking and what you want to do, how to develop your first portfolio site, all that kind of thing. And she talked to me about preparing for public speaking. So I spent a very enjoyable hour. Sat down with her in the radio studio talking about that. And she's got a whole bunch of other people on there. Hannah Mitchell's on there, and Bruce Lawson's on there, and a bunch of others. So they're only a couple of episodes in, but they're trickling them out over the course of the summer. So you should...
What was it called again?
It's called Pursuit Pod.
Nice. Check it out, Pursuit Pod.
You really should go and check that out.
And, actually, she's speaking at the Open Source Summit that I just mentioned.
Oh, is she? So, oh, excellent.
Yeah, she's going to be there as well.
Say hello for me.
She's a great speaker. She's a great speaker. She did one of the talks at the Community Leadership Summit once. And, yeah, she's fantastic. So,
yeah. Jess is brilliant.
What else do we... Do we have anything else? I mean, Jeremy's performed his Irish goodbye, so...
What's that mean?
Just disappear without saying anything.
Really? Why is that an Irish goodbye?
I don't know. I don't make the rules. It's just called an Irish goodbye.
No, it
isn't. Just basically slope out without saying anything.
In my experience, that's absolutely the opposite of how goodbyes work in Ireland. they normally take 2 or 3 hours and involve you going back in and having another round of smooth exits.
Speaking of speaking, I would like you to tell our lovely audience about that talk that you did, the UX talk. Because it's quite interesting. I think people would like to check it out. Oh, and I know you're not going to. I know you're not going to pimp it yourself. So I'm asking you to pimp it.
Oh, okay. I did a talk called "The UX of Text." It's essentially what it's about is the idea that we're seeing a load more things like chatbots and conversational interfaces. You've got we've talked about voice assistants, home assistants on the show already. Alexa and Google Home and so on and so forth. We've shut up, Alexa.
Lexi,
exactly. But you've also got things like Siri and so on. But there's also a big push towards chat interactions through things like Facebook Messenger and WhatsApp and Telegram and so on and so forth. And the key point about all these things is that they are text, right? So a lot of what we've called user experience design over the last 10, 15, 20 years, has a lot of it's been around user interface design, and specifically visual user interface design. So a lot of people out there who would call themselves UX designers, actually maybe what they're good at is graphics. And people who are genuinely doing user experience design are thinking below that, thinking about interactions and so on. And text is the key point of that, right? So as we move into a world in which a lot more of our interactions are dealt with through text, through voice, through typing things into a keyboard or seeing them on a screen, so you're not pointing and grunting at stuff. Your language is way more expressive, right? It's we've spent tens of thousands of years getting really, really good at it. And you can be you can be a lot more expressive with a poem than you can be with a photograph, right? There are a whole bunch of photographers now who could disagree with me.
I would say it depends on the photo.
Well, yeah, and it depends on the poem. But you see my point, there's a whole basically unexplored area. And it's a really interesting area to get into. Up until now, if you wanted to be great at designing user experience, you needed to either have or sit down with someone who has a great deal of graphical ability because of the aesthetic usability effect. But now, maybe you can make just as big a splash if you're a poet or if you're a linguist or you're an author rather than if you're a painter or a designer. So that's what the talk's about how we shape the user experience of textual and voice interactions. What's important about it, what's changed about it, and how you can get in on the ground floor and shape the new field.
Yeah, it's very good, and it's interesting.
Thank you. That's very kind of you. I wasn't planning on pimping it on the show, but
no, it's cool and it's interesting, and like you say, it's kind of blazing a trail in a new area, and this is particularly pertinent with things like, you know, with voice control assistants and whatever else. So, yeah, people go and check it out. It's linked on your blog, right?
I linked to it from Twitter. I need to actually link to it from the front page of the website, but it's on my YouTube channel. If you follow me on LinkedIn, I link to it there as well. Or just Google for the UX of text and you'll find it.
Nice. Good stuff. Well, yes. I guess we're out of stuff to talk about, aren't we?
Okay.
My brain's empty. So, not that there's much in there.
I wasn't going to say that. It did occur to me to say no change there, but I thought that would be mean, so I didn't.
Is thinking it and saying it, I mean, is it still wrong if you just think it? I don't know. Let's not go down that slippery slope, because I think horrible things all the time.
I was going to say, if thinking things is wrong, I really don't think you want to get on that train, to be honest.
Yes, I agree. All right, let's wrap it up.
So,
bye, everyone.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, and goodbye.